Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Deborah Sine, and I'm on the board of the Boston Book Festival, and I'd like to welcome you all here today. It's been an amazing day so far, and I'm sure what you're about to hear will make it even more amazing. I get the unbelievable pleasure of introducing Bill Littlefield, who is host of NPR and WBUR's Only a Game, which is syndicated in 220 public radio stations around the country. In fact, he's just finished celebrating his 25th year as host of that, and he's about to go into his 26th. He's also the author of several books on sports, two novels, and two collections of his radio and magazine commentaries. He's also the writer in residence at Curry College, a graduate of Yale University and the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Bill began broadcasting sports on WBUR in 1984, when it was really only a game. It is my pleasure, Bill Littlefield.
Thank you. We're gonna hear about some heroic figures today. Probably most of you are familiar, at least in part, with these heroic figures. One is Ted Williams and the other is John L. Sullivan, and they're both enormous names in the field of sport. So I thought it might be kind of fun to begin with some one heroic figure with whom you may not be so familiar, and then another little story about a person who may or may not, who's fictional, who may or may not ever get to be a heroic figure before we get to the two heroic figures. So I was told I had just a minute to try and sell my own book. That's what I'm gonna do. The one virtue of Take Me Out, which is my book, is that you will not get a hernia trying to carry it home. But anyway, this is my short piece about a local hero. To make of athletes heroes often seems a little silly, but if you're bound to do it, then consider Christine Lilly. No soccer-playing man has matched what Christine Lilly's done. She scored 130 goals and had sufficient fun to carry her beyond the point where other players stop. The list of most U.S. games played has Lilly at the top. And should you wonder at the number, as some people do, the numeral in question is 352. She won at the Olympics, and she won at the World Cup, and when the pro leagues faltered, well, she helped to prop them up. She was and is and will be U.S. soccer's greatest light. If you think she's a hero, I'd have to say you're right. And that also, thank you. One other short offering, so you'll know that just how serious this book is. This is called Mom, I'm Going to Be a Star. And this was my counterpoint to a culture that inordinately, I think, rewards athletes at a very early age and turns at least numbers of the young men in our culture into one-dimensional people who figure as long as they can throw a basketball through a hoop or pitch a baseball 90 miles an hour, there's no need to explore other avenues of learning. So, Mom, I'm going to be a star. I love you, child, for what you are. But I will make $1 million generating hoots and hollers. All the fans will shout my name. Maybe, child, and all the same, I will love you all my days if you do or don't win praise. Mom, I'll build a house for you, and it'll have an ocean view. That, my child, would be quite grand. Now sit with me and hold my hand, and know, in case you don't succeed, it's time for you to learn to read. Thank you. That was very nice. And now we'll get to the heart of the order. I've got before me two books, The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. Ben Bradley Jr. is the author of that one. And Strong Boy, The Life and Times of John L. Sullivan, America's First Sports Hero. And Christopher Klein is the author of that one. They are both exceptional. and the amount of work and the amount of study and time that these gentlemen have put into these books is absolutely apparent and evident to anybody who sits down to read them. They are masterpieces in the world of sports and beyond. So I urge you to take advantage of the opportunity to buy them at the end of this presentation. And my understanding that is that both gentlemen will sign them Your Best Pal. And Your Best Pal Ben, Your Best Pal Chris, whatever you prefer. And I certainly will do the same. So the way we're going to do this is I will ask questions of each of these authors for a little while, and by virtue of that, you'll learn something about the book, and I hope that their answers and maybe my questions will also spark some questions from you. I was telling Ben before we came up here, years ago, I was on a panel that was talking about a Ted Williams book that came out many years ago, one not nearly as ambitious as his. And we did the panel in the Boston Public Library Auditorium, and we could have gone on for days because everybody in the audience had a Ted Williams story that they wanted to tell, and everybody kept jumping up, and it was fantastic, and we may see some of that today as well. But I want to start with you. Was there any concern in taking on this task of writing a biography of Ted Williams that many people would already be familiar enough with Ted Williams so that they might think, oh my goodness, what else is there for me to learn?
Yes. Yeah, there was the concern. I came at it from a different perspective, though, than the early books. I was a reporter and editor at the Boston Globe for 25 years, never on the sports side. I was never a sports writer. I was just a fan, particularly a fan of Williams. I'm old enough that I saw him play as a kid the last three or four years of his career, and I would go to Fenway as often as I could, my room at home was plastered with pictures of Ted clipped out from Sports Illustrated and sport magazines, and I got his autograph once as a kid, and I was one of about 100 screaming brats waiting for him in the Players parking lot, which is where you'd go to get autographs, and he didn't always sign, but he stopped and signed that day, and impose some order and on the process, made us line up with our baseballs, and signed on the sweet spot, of course. And so I still have that ball, the ink fading badly with the passage of more than 50 years. So he'd been a figure in my life, and in his death, I was struck by how much interest there still was in his life and how many lives he had touched. I remember the Globe ran a couple of pages of letters, and they were from grandfathers talking about how they had introduced their sons to baseball through Ted and their sons to their sons. And so he was a certain glue in the social fabric. And I had read Ted's own autobiography in 1969 with interest, and a lot of the other books. They were all, the other books were mostly all done by sports writers, and I was not a sports writer. And these books celebrated his exploits on the field, but I found them quite thin in terms of what made him tick as a man, mm-hmm. and that's what interested me. I don't skimp on the baseball. There's plenty of baseball in those 800 pages. But I concentrate on really the rest of his life and particularly certain things that fascinated me, like him being Mexican-American. Who knew? And how he tried to conceal that and did conceal it all his life, worried that the prejudice of the day might affect his career. His troubled relationship with his mother, his anger, which was a double-edged sword, motivated him on the field. He said he always hit better, mad. So he would manufacture feuds with the sports writers who he always thought were out to get him, and then go off on a tear and hit 500 for a month. And but it caused him great problems, this anger, in his personal life, because it would bubble up at inappropriate times and places. I think he was probably bipolar, Williams, before they really knew and understood what that was. And so a lot of the book is devoted to exploring that. So long answer to your question, I thought there was plenty of room in the non-sports realm to do this biography.
Okay, now we're going to shift gears. Something of a challenge to write about a man who made his heroic exploits in the 40s, 50s, as late as 1960. Something else, a different challenge entirely, to write about John L. Sullivan, whom you identify in the subtitle as America's first sports hero. Tell me a little bit about how that designation is appropriate.
Well, I really think that here in Boston, where sports is really our secular religion, that Sullivan is not just among the pantheon of athletic gods. He really is our Zeus. And I found it really remarkable in doing the research into the book just what a seminal figure he was. And people often refer to him as the Babe Ruth of boxing, but in reality, Babe Ruth was the John L. Sullivan of baseball because he's the first athlete to earn $1 million. He had constant battles with the bottle, wild weight fluctuations, his womanizing, his drinking, his runs with the law were a godsend to a burgeoning newspaper industry. He's the premier sports figure of his century. And, you know, people think, all right, that's Babe Ruth, but John L. Sullivan was doing that 40 years before Babe Ruth. And you might think of him as this sepia-toned relic of a distant age, but he owned his own sports bar. He flirted with running for political office. He endorsed products. He starred in theatrical productions around the country. So he really is this modern-day figure, and you can find just about anything that's going on in modern sports, and I can make a connection back to what John L. Sullivan was doing back in the 1880s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think Sullivan comes along, the Gilded Age, 1880, and this is really when you start to see sports, you know, a decade after the Civil War, sports is now starting to become part of the American culture. He comes along at the right moment. He comes along when the newspaper industry is starting to take off, too, and he's great copy just for what he does inside the ring, but maybe a little bit more so what he's doing outside the ring at that time. It gets to a point that Sullivan is such a big name during the Gilded Age that people start paying money to see him pitch in exhibition baseball games. And he travels around the country doing these stage shows where he covers himself in white powder and poses like Greek and Roman statuary, and he's selling out theaters around the country. And it kind of just strikes me, you know, this is really what celebrity is. When people will pay good money to see you doing something that is not what your forte is, they just want to be in his presence. And even after he leaves the ring in 1892, he had his second life as touring around the country, starring these five-act melodramas. He was Simon Legree in Uncle Tom's Cabin, and he's still selling out theaters because people just wanted to be in the presence of John L. Sullivan. So I think, you know, before Sullivan comes along, there wasn't even such a thing as a professional boxer. There just wasn't enough money to be made in it. He's able to make $1 million, not just from what he did in the ring, but all these other sideline pursuits that he had. And I think you can really see that that's where the sort of the model of the American athletes is really born with him.
That was in the days when $1 million was real money.
Something, yeah, yeah, back then, right?
It strikes me that And you should feel free, either of you, to correct me if I'm wrong, but it strikes me that the two athletes you've written about had something substantial in common, beside the fact that they were incredibly famous and the very best they at what they did. But when John L. Sullivan kind of became the heavyweight champion, there was no sport in this country more popular than boxing, unless it was perhaps horse racing. And when Ted Williams was having his greatest years of success, there was no sport more popular in this country than baseball, because the NFL hadn't come along to claim that distinction, which quite obviously it has now.
Yeah, or basketball.
Well, but football, then basketball, and baseball somewhere down the line now. They had the first game of the World Series this year was the lowest rated World Series, first World Series game in TV in the modern era. So to what extent were those two figures responsible for that fact, or and to what extent did they simply benefit from it? Why don't you go first, Chris?
Well, I think there's a little bit of both, but I think what's really fascinating is where Sullivan is when he enters the sport and where he leaves it afterwards. So when Sullivan becomes heavyweight champion in 1882, boxing is fought under what's called the London Prize Ring rules, completely different than what we know of in boxing today. So fighting rounds lasted as long as one fighter was standing. As soon as a fighter got knocked down, they had 30 seconds to get up and another 8 seconds to get back to the middle of the ring. And fights went on until a fighter could no longer continue. So you see in Sullivan's day, he fought fights that lasted 2 hours, 3 hours, these astronomical round totals, 75 rounds against Jake Kilrain. And the sport is brutal. It's wrestling and boxing and punching are legal, but then there's certainly a great bit of extracurricular activity to go on during the fight, too, with biting, eye gouging a little bit in there. And so it's illegal in every state in the country. That's how violent a sport is. And just as much violence inside the ring, it could be even more violent outside the ring because it's just awash in gambling. So if you're ringside at one of John L. Sullivan's championship fights under these rules, it's like being on the floor of a stock exchange because there is just money flying everywhere, people yelling out odds, and it's a wild scene. So there's these great cat-and-mouse games that have to be done even to stage a boxing heavyweight championship match. So you would have a heavyweight championship match in the backwoods of Mississippi with the fans getting on a train and not knowing where they were going until the train got off and they were told that that's where the fight's going to be. They run off with the post, they put them into the ground, mount the ropes, and that's where they have a heavyweight championship fight. Sullivan never preferred to fight under those rules because he didn't want to deal with all the legal bills that came after it, and finally put his foot down and said, I want to fight under what's the modern-day rules, the Marquis of Queensbury rules. And with the time, 3-minute rounds, you know, the 10-second knockdowns. And Sullivan's last fight against Jim Corbett, if you saw an illustration of it, it looked like any fight scene you would see in Las Vegas today. It's in a 10,000-seat arena with electric lights. You know, there's just a great crowd around it. So, you know, he takes a sport where he shows up and it's illegal in every state in the country. And by the time he's done fighting, he's basically put boxing on the path to where it is today. So, you know, I think in that sense, he really transformed the sport into really setting the table for what would come in boxing, you know, during the 20s and the 30s and the 40s in that era.
And Williams obviously benefited from what had come before him in terms of making baseball the national pastime. But he did his share of bringing much more attention to the game as well.
Yeah. Well, he was one. He was the first guy to get an escalator clause in his contract for attendance. He reasoned that he was a big draw, and he was. He was in the 50s. He was the only. In fact, when the Red Sox had such terrible teams, he was the only reason to come to the park. As you suggest, baseball is in trouble today. Your anecdote about the low ratings for the World Series, and today, baseball is a distant third after pro football, pro basketball in terms of fan interest. And the game is too slow; it takes far too long to play. 4-hour games really taxes the patience of any spectator, I think. But Williams played in the golden age of baseball, the 40s, and particularly the 40s. And the Red Sox teams of that era were really good. They won the pennant in 46, lost to the World Series to the Cardinals in 7 games. And 48, they lost the pennant on the last day in a playoff game to the Cleveland Indians, and 49 lost the pennant on the last day of the season to the hated Yankees. And but in the 50s, they went into the tank, and Ted was the only person. But he was the straw that stirred the drink in this town for many decades.
Yeah. You're telling the story of how bad the Red Sox were during at least a fair portion of Ted Williams' career. Makes me want to ask a very specific question. This is a story that I had heard, and I know it's treated in your book as has been treated elsewhere. There is a story that says that the owners of the two teams, the Yankees and the Red Sox, sat down one night together and drank enough so that they decided they would trade Joe DiMaggio for Ted Williams. Mm-hmm. And then one or both of them woke up the next morning sober enough to realize that that probably was not a good idea and called it off. Can you kind of fill in the blanks on that?
Yeah. Well, this was Tom Yawkey, and then the owner of the Red Sox, and Dan Topping, the owner of the Yankees, getting quite inebriated at Toots Shores in New York. And after many martinis, they agreed in principle on a trade for Williams and DiMaggio, straight up. And it was exciting, and you know, Ted was the short porch of Yankee Stadium, and here the Fenway Park with the left field wall would have been good for Joe, presumably right-handed power hitter. And they agreed in principle to the trade, but Yawkey says, let's sleep on it, and we'll talk again in the morning. And so Yawkey called up his brain trust, such as it was, at Fenway Park, and they said, you're crazy. We can't do this. They pointed out that Williams was younger than DiMaggio, healthier than DiMaggio, and Joe, in fact, was on his way out. This was the late 40s, and he retired in 51. Williams played the entire decade of the 50s, and they said, you can't do the deal, to Yawkey. And so Yawkey was looking for a graceful way out of this. So he goes back to Topping and says, my guys don't like it. They'll only do the deal if you throw in Yogi Berra. And so that was the deal breaker.
Yeah, as it should have been. He only won the MVP, what, three times?
I guess, I don't know.
Tell me a little bit about the process by which you went about learning as much as you obviously learned about John L. Sullivan, because yes, you could see images of his final fights, but I bet it wasn't so easy to see images of his early fights, and probably not so easy even to find any kind of records.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's one video clip where you can see John L. Sullivan when he's basically in his 50s and 300 pounds trying to work a punching bag, but that's the only video clip you have. We only have images from two fights that he was in, so you don't really have that visual connection to the subject matter. You know, it was, with Sullivan, he was such a larger-than-life figure, I found, that very quickly after his death, much of what was written about him quickly got infected by the mythology of Sullivan. So,
like Billy the Kid. It's like,
yeah, well, I mean,
finding the real story is pretty tough.
Yeah, I mean, there's stories that, you know, he drank a quart of ox blood every day, which is ridiculous, because if you know John L. Sullivan, he only drank distilled liquids. He was not going to be drinking any sort of ox blood. Or he could pound in a nail with his fist and then pull it out with his teeth. And which is too bad, because I came across this great story, and I so wanted it to be true, that after Sullivan became a heavyweight champion, they had a bit of a problem over at Harvard with a hazing ring. So they hired John L. Sullivan, sent him undercover as a Quaker student to be to infiltrate this fraternity. Goes in, they start the hazing of it, basically takes off his disguise and starts pummeling half the kids in the room until the other half say they'll never haze again. I thought, this is great. I got to get in the book. Then I read the same story that it happened at Penn and Cornell and basically everywhere in the Ivy League. So, I had to throw that one out. So really, it was going back to the original newspaper records of the day and reading those accounts. And as close as you could get to Sullivan's era was where you're going to really find the closest bit of truth. And he did write an autobiography, too, but that was mainly a collection of newspaper articles from the time. He doesn't even mention the fact that he had a wife and a son, doesn't get into his personal life at all. So, you know, it was a challenge. You know, obviously there's no one to interview who had a personal connection to him. I was able to track down family members who have some stories, some memorabilia and such, but it really was just go back, find the primary source material as close as you can from the 1880s. There are a few documents that are in archives, pull those out, and that's where you're going to find the most reliable information.
Ben, you, on the other hand, did have the opportunity to interview all sorts of people who had known Ted Williams. Some had played ball with Ted Williams or against him. Tell me a little bit about a story that you wished was true and maybe didn't turn out to be true. Are there any like that?
Well, there I can't think of any. The thing about Williams is there's so many great stories that are true. You didn't have to make it up. Can I tell my favorite Ted Williams story? It's not even in the book, so you get extra credit here.
You're going to have to write a pamphlet to be tucked in the back.
It was the late 50s, no, mid-50s, and the old Washington Senators were in town playing the Sox at Fenway. And the Senators had Pedro Ramos pitching. Does anybody remember that name? He was a rookie, and he was a Cuban. And he's nervous going up against the great Williams. But the first time up, he strikes Ted out, which was a very unusual event. Ted hardly ever struck out. Ramos is quite excited about that. And in fact, so excited, after the game, in an act of great chutzpah, he takes the ball that he struck out Ted with, barges into the Red Sox clubhouse, approaches the great man, and asks him would he sign the ball that he struck him out with. Ted said, get the blankety blank out of here with that ball. I'll never sign it. But somebody prevailed upon him to go ahead and sign the ball for poor Pedro Ramos. So Ramos goes back to his clubhouse, one happy man. Fast forward 2-3 weeks later, the Senators are back in town, and Ramos is pitching again. Up comes Ted, puts the first pitch 20 rows up in the bleachers. He's rounding third, yells over to Ramos, I'll sign that son of a bitch, too, if you can find it. So all the Ted stories are good, you know.
Right. No problem. I'm curious about how there are Williams family members remaining. Some of them, or at least one of them, I understand, is not entirely pleased with the book. Is that correct?
You must be referring to Claudia Williams, his daughter. Yeah. Well, I think my breakthrough in the book in terms of getting new material was convincing his two daughters to speak for the first time. They'd never spoken before. And Bobby Jo, the older daughter, was estranged from the family. Ted had written her out of his will and refused to have anything to do with her anymore. And she died unexpectedly and very obscurely back in Tennessee 5 or 6 years after I talked with her. Never even an obituary. It's very, very strange. Mm. And Claudia, I spent many, many hours with Claudia. This is the youngest daughter by Ted's third marriage and the brother of John Henry, who was the one who responsible for the sad cryonics affair, which dominated the postmortems of Williams' life. And he had agreed to talk with me, but then got leukemia and died, a young man at 33. So Claudia sort of filled in for John Henry and talked with me at great length, told me her version of what happened in the cryonics affair and many, many other details about Ted's life and what it was like to grow up with such a demanding, dominant personality. And, you know, certain parts of her account, my reporting suggested otherwise, and she wasn't pleased with that, I think. That's how it goes.
That's how it goes, exactly. The risk one runs. We got about half an hour. Do you guys think you have half an hour worth of questions to ask these guys? See some activity out there?
Not as well as you can do it.
Well, I'll keep going for a few more minutes if you like. I'm curious with the work that you did to get into the life of John L. Sullivan and to some extent into the sort of the mechanics and the day-to-day activity of boxing at the time that he was active and then beyond, because as you say, his influence extended well beyond his actual active career. Did you come away from all that work with a sense of the value of boxing? Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, there's like such debate about boxing. You know, there are people on both sides. Some people say boxing is a great sport because it enables people who have very few other avenues towards success to make some success of themselves, and others say, what is the point of making a success of yourself if you end up with dementia at the age of 45? So did you have come away with a sense of sort of the place of boxing in a culture today?
I came away with a sense of boxing in the 1880s, 1890s during Sullivan's era, and, you know, I'm not much of a boxing fan, not a boxing historian. It's, you know, Sullivan's life as much outside the ring as inside the ring that drew me in. And I think it was also using Sullivan as a vehicle to examine sort of the rise of sports in American society, the birth of celebrity culture, and then also to tell the story a little bit about the Irish in Boston in that generation after the Great Famine back in Ireland. Because I think the one connection between boxing back in the Gilded Age and boxing today is it really is a mirror of the immigration into America and that part of the American experience. So when Sullivan comes along, you know, boxing really is predominantly dominated by Irish fighters, Irish-American fighters. You actually have the case of Jewish fighters will change their name to Irish-sounding names just to be able to be accepted in society at that time. And so really, the value of boxing in overall society was really the value of boxing in to Irish America at that time. Because here you have John L. Sullivan comes along as the symbol of the most powerful man in the world. A generation after the potato famine, you've got the Irish who've been, you know, suffered through the trauma of that. They've had been oppressed in their own homeland for a couple of centuries by the British. And to have this symbol of the most powerful man in the world and have Celtic blood running through his veins was such an important moment for Irish Americans and also for the Irish in Boston. And you see the ascent of the Irish in boxing coming along at the same time that they're coming of age in politics in Boston, too. You have the first Irish-American mayor in 1885, I believe, is when he took office, right during the middle of Sullivan's reign. And, you know, you have actually Sullivan such a big figure that there was a rival newspaper editor who named another fighter to be the heavyweight champion of America and because he said that Sullivan was ducking his fighter. Well, Bostonians got collected $10,000, and they had a big ceremony at one of the theaters, sold out, where they gave Sullivan his own championship belt made of 16-karat gold and had 400 diamonds on it. and the Irish-American mayor was in attendance. And it's sort of like this was the moment, the coming of age of the Irish, you know, in Boston that would last for, you know, obviously more than a generation when it came to the politics. But then, you know, subsequent to the Irish in boxing, then the story turns to African Americans, Italian Americans. You know, I think now we're talking about, you know, Hispanics, Americans, Asian Americans. So it really is that prism view of the history of America through boxing. And I think, you know, just as much as you can do it today, you did it back then too.
Yeah. Yeah. Any sports writer that you talk to today will tell you that the profession has changed dramatically for a variety of reasons. One is, of course, newspapers aren't what they used to be. I don't know how many daily papers did Boston have when Ted Williams came? Nine. Now
nine.
They have. Now they
Can
have
you believe
one and
that?
One and a half.
Yeah.
So the whole thing has changed, obviously.
I think I know which one is the half, but I...
Well, we'll let everybody decide for themselves.
I'm just waiting.
But one of the things that has changed the whole business of reporting in general and sports writing in particular is that everybody has a Twitter account, everybody has a cell phone, everybody has the ability to not only take photographs but take video and put it up on the web. You know, so that if a player comes stumbling out of a nightclub at 2 a.m. and some guy who's working as a parking lot attendant recognizes that player, 15 minutes later, it's on YouTube and everybody can see it. How would Ted have handled the kind of publicity that's generated by the social media generation?
Well... I'm not sure he would have acted all that differently. You know, he was an original. People back in those days, the writers were the stars of their profession, and it was a very corrupted atmosphere. The teams paid for the writers to travel. They paid for their hotel rooms. They paid for 6 weeks in spring training. I mean, just unthinkable stuff that one couldn't really imagine today. And for that money, they expected good coverage, and they generally got it. Ted would just give the... He always thought that he got a bad press. Actually, he got a good press. He most of his the coverage was positive. He had a few antagonists, particularly a name which some of you may remember, Dave Egan, the Colonel, he went by and was his pen name, wrote for the old Daily Record. And his mission was to give... Ted owned the town, and so he wanted to tear Williams down, and he called him T. Williams Esquire. And Ted would follow him carefully, and but he would tar the press with a bad brush because certain people would go after him, and he would when they came into the locker room after the clubhouse after the game, he would say, "What are you bastards? What kind of trouble are you going to stir up today?" And talk to them this way. And the other players were amused at this because none of them would dare treat the writers this way. Remember Don Budden, the shortstop of the 50s, better known as Bootin' Budden to some people. For his propensity to drop ground balls, hit to him at shortstop, told me that one day after a typical theatrical display of Ted's, he said, "Ted, how can you treat the writers this way? They have a job to do." Ted said, "Son, you hit 350, you can do a lot of things." So I don't think he would have treated the tweeters and the social medias people any different than he would. He was sort of true to himself.
Okay. Now we only have 20 minutes left and a hand or two have gone up. So I want to give you guys a chance to ask questions, and you can address your question to either of Ben or Chris or even to me if you want me to read another piece of doggerel. Could happen.
So I have a question about Ted Williams. I know we're at a book festival, but I've always been curious why there hasn't been a major motion picture ever made.
Just hold on. There might be.
Coming. It's coming up.
Yeah, there's an option on my book, but, you know, I was telling Bill that only a fraction of these option deals get made, so we'll see.
Who would play Ted Williams?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
It'd be tough.
Well, Williams is such a mythic hero here in Boston, but he was always associated with this town, and I wonder whether or not we can have any more mythic heroes because who are those guys on the field? You know, you don't really know anymore. They trade them so quickly. Mm. What do you think would be what was Williams' relationship with the town in terms of his feelings for it? And will we have any more mythic heroes given the culture that we're in now?
I doubt it because, as you say, we're in the culture of free agency and teams hop, I mean, guys hop around. Williams spent all 20-odd years of his career in Boston, and he had sort of a love-hate relationship with the town. He was tormented by a very vocal minority who would sit out on the left field grandstand and torture him. He had very thin skin. He couldn't accept any criticism. He reasoned that he was the best at what he did. He worked hard. He tried his best. And he thought that any criticism was largely unfair. He couldn't tolerate any press criticism of delving into his personal life. And so he was naive about the press and about celebrity culture. But he came to really love Boston. And ironically, his fame and legend grew exponentially in retirement. Mm-hmm. People came to appreciate him more after he was gone, how much of an original he was, how much of, sticking to his guns and they admired his principled stand, even if it hurt him in the short term. So really he outlasted the writers whom he criticized so much, and they came around to his point of view.
It's a fascinating question. Let me offer a possibility. If it's true, I mean, what I'm told, for example, at my place of employment is that when you write a blog, you have to be bang, bang, bang. No details, get it out there, then get on to the next one, because people don't have the attention span or the inclination to read anything longer than 160 words. So, or a tweet, which is 140 characters or whatever the hell it is. So here's a possibility. Maybe we have evolved so that we don't expect our mythic figures to be there for 20 years anymore. David Ortiz is just fine. He comes up with Minnesota. He doesn't do too much of anything with them. He gets traded to the Red Sox. He has a couple of spectacular years. They win a couple of championships, and he becomes the myth du jour. You don't have to be Ted Williams anymore to assume that sort of stature. Maybe that's what we've become as a culture, what we've learned to change our expectations. You've given me an idea for a commentary, so be on next week on Wednesday, way here in the back.
I have a question for Ben, mainly. In this era of statistics in baseball, I wonder about greatness and Hall of Fame kind of greatness and reputations. I notice in lists of the greats, Joe DiMaggio is now lower than he used to be. I'm wondering if that's just because he didn't play as many years as some other people. A Pedro Martinez, who was the greatest for 4 or 5 years, didn't have a long, really long career. A certain San Francisco pitcher who's now in the World Series as a reliever was great for 3 or 4 years. I'm wondering if what people remember as someone who is just amazing and superb and totally remarkable is as worthy of the term great as someone who had the 20-year career and the big statistics?
Well, greatness is certainly in the eye of the beholder and probably an overused term. Williams had a .344 lifetime batting average, which is pretty amazing. And One of the great parlor games that people play in discussing Williams is that people have to remember he missed 5 years of his prime. his absolute prime to fighting in World War II in Korea. And so it's a fun game. What would his final numbers have been had he not missed those years of those 5 years in his prime? And he probably would have been up about nearly 700 home runs, just shy of Ruth's 714 and well over 3,000 hits. But I argue in the book that for his legacy, his service in those two wars, and not just doing KP duty, mind you, he was an elite Marine Corps fighter pilot who didn't see action in World War II. He was so good they held him back as an instructor. But he was—he flew 39 combat missions in Korea. John Glenn was his wingmate and called him the best pilot he'd ever seen. And survived a crash landing. And I argue that for his legacy, his service in those two wars was more important than the 5 years he missed, because it gave him a heroic aura that he otherwise would not have had. And I think his service in those two wars is especially notable when compared to the unfathomable prospect that today's superstar athlete would fight in one war, never mind two. Can you see A-Rod in Iraq or Afghanistan?
Of course, it's also safe to say that wars have changed. World War II was one thing. Iraq and Afghanistan are something else entirely. So much for the political portion of the presentation. Other questions?
Ben, I had a question. On a trip out to San Diego, I was shocked to see that they had a whole display of Ted Williams in the Sports Museum in Balboa Park.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask how San Diego figures in your book.
Oh, I start there. I start there. And he grew up in San Diego in the Depression. He had a fascinating mother with whom he had a contentious relationship. She would work for the Salvation Army. And that was her passion in life. And she was out until all hours of the night, saving souls on the streets of San Diego, but never home to cook Ted and his younger brother, Danny, a meal. So they were some of the first latchkey kids out till 10 or 11 o'clock at night on the front porch waiting for mom to come home. And the father was an alcoholic and largely absent and not a factor. And so San Diego figures prominently in the book. And I, as I alluded to at the beginning, I explored his Mexican roots. The mother was Mexican and had been born there. And Ted decided to conceal this, worried about the prejudice of the day. And one of my first moves was to go up to Santa Barbara, where the extended Mexican side of the clan lived. And I found a friendly first cousin of Ted's, and she said, come on up, we'll put together a family meeting for you. And they were proud of their famous cousin, but also resentful that he had ignored them for most of his life and chosen to conceal his Mexican-American heritage. And they told me this one fascinating story to illustrate that. But in 1939, after Ted's rookie year here, he returned to San Diego, the conquering hero. And about 100 of the Mexican side of the family turned out at the train station to greet him. Ted takes one step off the train, sees all the Mexicans waiting for him, and hightails it in the other direction, wouldn't be seen with him. And that still sticks in their craw to this day.
I would think. Yeah. I would think it would. Yes?
It's kind of interesting when we think about sort of local heroes, whether it's Ted Williams or Bill Russell or people like that and how much fame they have here. But when you think about writing about somebody like Don L. Sullivan, who at one point might have been considered the most well-known athlete in the world, and then many decades later, Muhammad Ali, perhaps being the greatest known athlete of all time around the world, that there may be a lot of people that never even heard of Joe DiMaggio or Mickey Mantle or Ted Williams. Why is it that that sport, which hasn't really garnered that much attention, particularly in recent years, maybe had
given birth to two of the most renowned athletes around the world. Is it something about outside the U.S. that made them such popular figures?
I think that's partly it. I mean, boxing is a sport that does transcend national borders. Sullivan, was heavyweight champion here for 5 years, and then he did a tour in the British Isles, and it was like reverse Beatlemania. It was the American going to England, and he was in England at the same time that Buffalo Bill was. And these two guys were they were famous in America, but even in England, people were starting to get that American culture starting to get imported there. But I think really it was more a symbol of, boxing was just as big in England and Ireland as it was in America. In fact, the son of Queen Victoria, who's the future King Edward VII, requested to have Sullivan fight an exhibition in front of him for a royal audience, which caused a bit of a scandal in the British papers that you had a future British king watching an Irish-American fighter. But Sullivan was big, in all the English-speaking countries in the world, and they were, towards the end of his career, they were trying to bring in fighters from different countries. But I think, unlike baseball and American football, that really are specific to the United States in terms of their popularity, boxing really is this global sport, and one that, there's not a lot of investment in equipment that has to be done in other countries that might not be as prosperous as the United States. And obviously Ali comes along at a time where he's able to fight literally all over the world, from United States to Zaire and back, and really make that connection. So I think it is a sport that, particularly now from what I've heard too, and it's still, boxing is much bigger over in the British Isles and Europe than it is in America at this point too.
There's another interesting point that your question triggers. I don't know how many people in this room could currently name the heavyweight champion of the world. We don't think of boxing as a major sport now in our country necessarily, but every year the Wall Street Journal puts out a list of athletes who've made the most money in the past year, and the boxers are always, the top two or three boxers are always at the top, but they're not heavyweights. So that's kind of an interesting change. There's a quote that jumped into my mind with your question, and it comes from Norman Mailer. I'm going to butcher the quote, but I hope we'll get the sense of it at least, when he was writing about Ali and Foreman. And he was speculating on why it is that there's still an aura around the heavyweight champion. And there certainly was with John Sullivan. There certainly was, as you pointed out, with Muhammad Ali. And his speculation is there is at least the possibility that he's the toughest man in the world. Which is pretty cool. I mean, I hate boxing. I have no use for boxing, but that's pretty cool.
I'll just add a postscript, which is I went to grade school in the Bronx, and one of my classmates was named after John L. Sullivan.
Ah, very good.
Yes. How could he not be? What was he supposed to be, an accountant?
That poor kid.
There's somebody right there.
As Ben said, Ted was not only the greatest hitter ever lived, he was also the greatest pilot and possibly the greatest fisherman. Mm-hmm. But neither one of these men were the greatest husbands. Would you like to talk a little bit about why they had so much trouble with their wives?
And would you like to be married to Ted Williams?
No. Or John L.
Maybe that's better asked of a woman. But he was a 6'4", extremely handsome guy, and he was a celebrity. And so women were constantly available to him, and he partook at every stage of his life, and which didn't help the marriages. But as I suggested earlier, it was more his anger and volatility which doomed his marriages. I talked to two of his three wives. The first died in 88, and they described a very difficult man to get along with. And, you know, he was self-centered and self-indulgent and didn't want to have much to do with his kids until later in life, as sometimes happens. But it was this, it was his anger. And I delve into that, the source of it, and I think it was probably rooted in the resentment of his mother for never being there for him growing up. But he was just too hard to live with. And he, you know, how much, you know, there was no cruising speed. There would just be these outbursts and volatility and just too hard.
And I'd say with Sullivan, it was the drinking. I mentioned he's the first athlete to earn $1 million. By his own estimation, he spent $500,000 of it on booze. And it led to a very troubled marriage. And he and his wife, Annie, you know, there were reports, even in the press back then, that they were getting into arguments, that John L. was striking, you know, Annie, and she had denied it to the press, but that was really what a woman was supposed to do at that time until finally she had enough, and she all of a sudden filed for divorce in Boston and listed in there the specific incidents of domestic violence. And, you know, if you think that was in the news about Ray Rice recently, you know, back in the 1880s in Boston, that was huge news, and there was a sensational two-day divorce trial. They both took the stand, and the judge went back to his chambers and in about 10 minutes denied the divorce request, showing you where men and women were at that time in America. John L. comes along. They stayed legally married for 23 years, although separated, and then in 1908 he decides he wants a divorce, and he gets it like that. But what I found, you know, what nice about Sullivan was that there's ultimately a redemptive chapter in his life. When he's in his 40s, he all of a sudden gives up drinking. And to me, this is the biggest mystery in his life because he was for sure an alcoholic. And by his, you know, account, he, you know, added up in his mind how much he had spent on booze and decided to give up drinking. And by all accounts, he did it for the last 13 years of his life. He, you know, after he got that divorce, he married a childhood sweetheart. He was a very much an absent father to his own flesh and blood son who died when he was 2 years old. But John and his second wife, they adopted, not legally, but they brought in a boy that lived with them for 8 years. And by all accounts, he was a great stepfather to this child. He was great with all the kids in the neighborhood. So, you know, I think that's what was, you know, to me, writing about it, you know, he had some loathsome qualities, but then at the end, you know, he really does right a lot of these wrongs that he had in his personal life early on. And
I think that's an important point. I also looked for a redemptive part of Williams, and think I found it. I struggled with the getting the right tone in the book. I uncovered a lot of things about this guy that were pretty bad. And often cruel, and so it could have been easy just to leave it at that and leave the wrong impression. But ultimately, I decided that his was a redemptive story. That while he struggled greatly with anger and didn't know how to contain it or really understand its source, ultimately he had a good heart, as evidenced chiefly by the work that he did for the Jimmy Fund here, which many of you may know about. He raised millions of dollars for that charity, but more importantly, he spent countless hours with kids who, in that era, almost all died of cancer. And he would go to doctors and nurses and give them his phone number and say, if you think I can bring a moment of good cheer to these kids, You call me at any time. And he was there, often, you know, on the floor and spending the night and holding their hands and doing the really tough work. And that impressed me about him. And he was also kind to others who were down on their luck. You know, he had a guy, sort of a man Friday, who acted as a cash courier, and he would go and give the guy, you know, $1,000 in cash and have him spread it around to people that he knew were hurting for money, and never to tell the source of where it came from. And when he was raising money for the Jimmy Fund, he might call an old teammate, and the guy would be, you know, wasn't doing that well financially, and he'd say, he'd hem and haw, and Ted, you know, I'm not doing that well. And Ted would say, God damn it, this is Ted Williams. I'm asking you, send me $10 and a check. And Ted would take the number on the guy's account and send him $1,000 anonymously. So he had a good heart.
Well, I think we've reached the end of our session, and I'm sorry to all of you who have Ted Williams stories or questions that you didn't have a chance to tell or ask. Likewise, John L. Sullivan stories or questions. But all of your questions will be answered if you simply go outside and buy the appropriate books. And I urge you to do so, not only because they are fascinating and very much worth reading, but also because the holidays are coming. So thank you.